Hello, and welcome to the Indie Dev Podcast. I'm your host, David Voiles. With me this week is Sean Woods. Sean is a gaming veteran of 18 years. His background spans everything from interactive CD-ROMs and TV commercials in the late 90s to creating orcs and UI for one of my favorite franchises, Dawn of War, Company of Heroes, and Homeworld 2, as well as art direction at Microsoft, and finally co-founding Alpha Dog Games, which focuses on mobile games. Alpha Dog was founded in 2012 in Halifax, Canada. Their original home, Wraithborn, was created by three full-time people and three contractors in only 6 months. It's featured on Touch Arcade as one of the most anticipated games and also featured by Apple at launch. Without any ad spend, it managed to get over 1.5 million installs. And most recently, their second game, Monstrosity Rampage, was developed over a two-year period as a team slowly grew over time. Their back-end technology was built from scratch, and an engine framework was integrated into their the Unreal Engine 3. The studio is currently focused on building mobile-first original IP with a mass appeal, and I want you to welcome Sean Woods. So, Sean, thank you for hopping on today.
Hi, Dave. It's a pleasure to be here, and it was nice to meet you this past GDC, and I look forward to the chat.
Likewise. So GDC, for those who aren't in play, is a game developer conference, the world's largest game development conference located in San Francisco each year. And I have a lot of friends who are Canadian, and we had met at a Canadian event that they're kind of putting together. And instantly, your game, Monstrosity, had caught my attention. So I want to highlight what you're doing, what your team's doing, and you know, how you kind of put this whole thing together.
Sounds good. Happy to help out and fill in what I can talk about.
Sure thing. So let's take a step back. You started in games quite a while ago. How'd you get your start? Were you programming, doing art? How'd you learn to get into the industry?
Yeah, so I'm, I guess just for a point of reference, I'm 37, going on 38 now. So mm-hmm. I kind of grew up playing games on primarily the original Sega and NES, and then, you know, Super Nintendo and Sega Genesis consoles. So my childhood is filled with many hours playing with those games and some of the early PC games as well. So every day or every summer, my father was a principal at a school and used to bring home computers for the summer. So, you know, the old Tandy 1000s and such, got to play some games on those. So as a gamer, I kind of started out, I guess, in the late 80s, early 90s, primarily. My high school never really had much to provide in terms of any sort of gaming programming courses and such. There was a basic programming course there and some basic art and such, etc., but nothing, you know, 3D related or animation or computer programming like some schools in high school offer now.
Yeah, so, different world today, right?
Yeah. We have co-op students from high school just down the road here that are quite talented already in terms of what they've been doing.
Yeah.
So it's changed in 20 years.
So point, you were getting into programming or art. Like what sparked your interest?
Yeah. Early on, what really sparked my interest were the games that allowed me to get my own art in the game, like the old EA PC games for hockey or NASCAR racing, where it allowed you to swap out textures and create your own textures. So, you know, I did a lot of in Microsoft Paint way back then and kind of got familiar with, you know, skins. And that was pretty cool. And on the programming side, it was just kind of tinkering with different languages at the time, QBasic and Pascal. And then I got into web programming, which was pretty cool because that was right during the revolution, I guess, of the information age.
Absolutely. Okay, so you started with like art, tinkering. I guess it'd be like a light version of modding, right? And even with all the tinkering skins you're doing, you see how popular you know, like custom content is, right? Minecraft, people are modding it all the time, adding their own textures, creating their own worlds. People want to say often it's the new craze for today, but I mean, you're showing that it's not today. It's been around for a very, very long time.
Yeah, it's been around for pretty much 20 years, especially on the PC. And it's pretty interesting to see how my 10-year-old daughter and 5-year-old son are so interested in Minecraft skins now and swapping about and getting new mods and things. It's quite a bit different than what it used to be, but at the same time, it's been around for a long time. So
absolutely.
It's pretty cool to see.
And you grew up in Canada. What is the state of the Canadian game development scene? Like, how would you rate it overall? How do people get involved?
Canada, I think, is right up there in the world in terms of awareness. Obviously, in Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal are the biggest hotbeds for both city population and gaming. Nova Scotia is a small market. I kind of consider us the Finland of Canada. We have a lot of talented individuals here, and the tech industry in general is starting to pick up over the last 5 years. So I'm really kind of excited to be in a smaller market where you can just kind of sit back, stay focused, and focus on what you do best, and without all the noise and distractions and big city life around you. But Vancouver's been growing exponentially. Montreal and Toronto have been great as well.
So it sounds like you really have, like, I guess, three hotbeds, and now Halifax is perhaps the newest at this point, or Nova Scotia, I should say.
Yeah. Well, most of us would be in Halifax, but there's about, in the gaming industry, there's about 500 people here in this small market, but also in the animation industry is actually quite large and growing here, which I went to animation school, so they're kind of related in terms of crossover artists and animators and such, but... it's all part of the sort of tech industry for me. So it's growing.
And now, does the Canadian government offer any side kind of tax incentives or benefits, or I should say advantages over being located in the United States?
It varies from province to province. There are various tax credits structured differently. So. For instance, British Columbia has, I think, a 17% tax credit. Quebec is probably one of the best in Canada. I think they're, don't quote me on that, but I think it's over 40%.
Nice.
Ontario's pretty good, too. Nova Scotia's, I guess, there's a couple ways of how that works, but basically for every person you have on salary, you can claim back part of that salary in a tax credit, and it's about 40%.
Oh, nice. So it essentially incentivizes people to want to become entrepreneurs, grow their business, start, stay, and grow in the region they're in.
Yeah, exactly. Like part of the challenge of A, being a small market, and B, being trying to be a growing market in the tech industry is that it's very difficult to attract the talent away from those big cities and provinces. It's all, after, basically on the back end is what I call it. So there's no money up front. It's not a grant or anything. Right. You have to actually have money to make the game, and then and then you're able to claim those jobs back for the salaries after. But, I mean, the stipulation is they have to be living and working in Nova Scotia as well. So it really promotes growth of the industry, and without it, it'd be very difficult to be a startup company here and to be a growing company as well, because it provides both.
Yeah, definitely. At a beautiful spot in Canada. I've been there several times, like I said before, because my in-laws live up there. But I think the license plates say Canada's Ocean Playground or something of that effect.
Yeah. It's a neat place. It's very quite stunning, actually. I still haven't visited everywhere myself. I've lived here about 4.5 years now, 5 years, I guess. I still haven't seen the whole province, but just the visuals of Cape Breton in the north, etc., is pretty stunning.
Yeah, it's like Canada's best kept secret.
Yeah.
Okay, so you did went to school for animation, got to start modding things, and then afterwards you got some big names under your belt. But having worked on titles like Dawn of War, Company of the Heroes, how did you transition into that, and then what was your transition out of it?
I had kind of a stepping stone career. I grew up in Manitoba, out near Winnipeg, and obviously Winnipeg's not a huge video gaming city,
I think it's the
especially at the
Winnipeg
time.
Jets.
Yeah, I was at the very last Jets game, which is
Oh,
pretty
nice.
funny. Shed a little tear for that, so glad to
Yeah.
hear the back. So anyways, in the late 90s, there wasn't much going on there. You basically kind of had to move away. And so what I did was multimedia schools were very popular at the time. And so I went to one of the private schools and spent a lot of money doing that. And then, I did get my first job in Winnipeg, working for a really interesting company in multimedia. And great group of people there that I'm still friends with now. And it really kind of springboarded my way into the industry, not so much the gaming industry, but just the entertainment industry. We were doing a lot of things like interactive kiosks or the CD-ROMs back then, where you're doing interactive CD-ROMs, even some TV commercials for local radio stations and various kind of marketing and presentations and such. So it really kind of was good exposure over those 3 years. But after that, I was around 21 and finishing up kind of playing junior hockey there, and decided to go back to college and focus more on animation, and ended up going to Capilano University in Vancouver.
The reason I ask is because, often I'll get students or young entrepreneurs who will ask me, how do you get started in tech or video games? So I'm always interested to see how everyone got their start, so I can often relay that information and say, there are so many different paths to get in. Everyone takes their own unique path. So it's just inspiring to hear how people go from, university, or they might play hockey for a little while, do their own thing, and realize, I want to change my career path. And, depending on where you live and what the current state of the industry is, different opportunities arise.
Yeah, exactly. And at the time of moving, like I really did want to kind of get into TV commercials and such, and movies, kind of like the Pixar route, when I was first going to animation school. But as I went through the school, I was just realized my strengths at the time were in modeling and texturing, 3D and 3D characters and such. So in the video game industry was actually picking up there in Vancouver and in the early 2000s, I guess, at that time. So it just kind of naturally went towards video games. I never thought that I would actually kind of get into it as a career at that time. But 15 years later from that animation school, I'm still here.
And you kind of stayed with it.
So I got my first job there, basically at Relic Entertainment, and was pretty cool. I worked on a lot of different projects there. I had a user interface background as well from graphic design, so I ended up doing all of the original UI design for the original Dawn of War, and primarily the orcs for modeling and texturing and the character side. So
All
yeah, it was a
right.
lot of fun.
I put a lot of time into that. I actually went through it again about 6 months ago.
The original?
So even
Oh yeah.
on my Twitch stream I'm watching now, if you look back months, I was going through it. I absolutely loved it.
That was a lot of fun. It was a great team. We were a small team, didn't just the other team was Company Heroes, and it was just getting started really early and not really having knowing where it was going to go. So it was pretty cool to be on Dawn of War, and then when that was done, move over to Company Heroes. And kind of in between all that, I was helping out the Homeworld 2 team on some of their UI design as well. So not for very long, but it was a pretty fun project.
That's nice. And which city? This is located in Vancouver.
In Vancouver, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, it's a bit. I when I think of Vancouver, I always think of basically the Seattle of Canada.
Yeah, it's kind of similar. Seattle's a pretty interesting city too. Vancouver's is a beautiful city. It is really like one of the top five in the world for me. The mountains are gorgeous. The weather is, the summers are amazing. Some winters are a little bit rainy, but the summers are absolutely amazing.
The water everywhere.
It's a really kind of pleasant, active city where you can live and work downtown.
I've got to go by again. Okay, so worked at Relic for a bit, not got the AAA games going, and then founded Alpha Dog Games in 2012. How did this come about? Right now you're suddenly on the other side of the country. You're now a co-founder of a studio. Like, what What sparked that change, that interest? Like, what made you want to make that jump? Because that's a pretty big move for just about anybody.
I was at I was actually working at Microsoft at the time, and in Vancouver it was Microsoft Studios, which is now the Coalition team. So I was part of the original, basically the original team putting helping hire that whole team that morphed into the Coalition. It's, you know, kind of changed now. It went from sort of social games into core console games.
Gears of War 4, right?
Yeah.
And now
But
it's so big. I was just talking to a bunch of people yesterday. They're doing like esports tournaments in Atlantic City and Vegas for, you know, through the Coalition, and it's wild.
yeah, it's pretty spectacular. I do miss that opportunity to have been a part of that team, the Gears of War franchise. An awesome project to work on. But I did leave just, I guess, before Microsoft bought the rights from Epic. So I originally moved to Halifax because my wife is from here, and we were moving here to raise our family. So I just decided to sort of settle down in a smaller community where she grew up, and moved across the country. I left Microsoft, didn't have a job or anything, didn't know what the market was like here at the time, and just through friends and mutual friends, I eventually met up with my business partner, Jeff Cameron, and we decided to start Alpha Dog. He had worked 10 years in the New York scene, and both he and his wife are from the Halifax region, and moved back for the same family reasons. So we decided to start up and kind of make a, you know, our own sort of lifestyle company in terms of making games and being able to accommodate our young families.
Okay, so it sounds like back in the Halifax area, Nova Scotia, a good place to raise a family. And your co-founder, he also had game development experience, I suppose.
So we kind of complement each other in terms of what we do. He has a technology background, so he was the, you know, the lead programmer to start, and I was handling the art and creative aspect.
Oh, okay. So yeah, you definitely go hand in hand really well. And then your first title, Wraithborn.
Wraithborn.
So how did that all come together? Like, because everyone's got an idea, but you put it on paper and actually got something out the door, which is a rarity in and of itself because shipping is a skill. So if you cover basically, how did you get other people to buy into the idea of this? And then how did you get it out the door?
With Wraithborn specifically?
Yes.
So that was back in 2012 when he opened, and we did have a third original partner who was a game designer. So we covered all three, areas of game development, and then we had some help from about three other kind of contract workers in terms of some concept art, 3D modeling, and animation. So it all started. We got some small funding through a local kind of government agency here called the COA. That is basically a loan, a small loan. So, got about $60,000 or so to start it up. And we originally focused on Wraithborn as an action RPG because we felt like using Unreal Engine, it was something that we could pull off in a shorter period of time. So the game was made in about 6 months originally, and by the small team that we had, getting all the art and whole production, we got up and running pretty quickly because we have worked together before in various aspects. So, it's part of that is knowing who you're working with and how you work together. So we were able to get up and running pretty quickly using Unreal Engine, especially at that time in 2012. There was no, Unreal 4, no Unity 5 or anything like that.
That was my next question is, why Unreal as opposed to rolling your own, doing your own?
Yeah, so at that time when we were just starting, we had all just finished a couple sort of contract work pieces in Unreal 3 and really started to like it in terms of usability and such. So we're pretty familiar with it, got us up and running pretty quickly, and we're able to execute on it. So the whole target for that game was just we're a small team, let's try to do something that's kind of visually different and interesting that we can pull off in a more core space, And it's an action RPG. So it was originally a premium title.
Premium, and you get to pay up front for the title.
Yeah, yeah. So I think it was about $3. We got a lot of traction early on. We had originally it was published by Crescent Moon Games, okay. And then we later on just kind of got the rights back.
Yeah.
But it was interesting getting it up and running fast and on device, really fast. Testing on the iPhones every day, multiple times a day, mm-hmm. really helped to kind of bring that game together. And to, you know, get it out there and shipping it and getting some press on it was, it just kind of all came together really well, because the game at that time, you know, showed itself off nicely on device, since we were kind of working on more core graphics.
Especially when you look at, you know, even the reviews through Google Play, so the Android store, where you have 29,000 reviews, which is fantastic. 15,900 of them are 5 stars, and your total rating is 3.9. So
yeah,
it's up there. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, a lot of those 1 stars are probably just we changed the game from premium to free, or didn't work. Yeah. So yeah, it didn't work on that device. We didn't really do much on Google for calling out devices, but yeah, that's usually what it is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a project sometimes. You know, you got to manage all these different devices and expectations for each one. You're playing, you know, hitting a moving target. It's, you know, it's one of those issues with, you know, mobile development that you have no control over.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. And we really learned that, especially launching Monstrosity, how you had to be on top of those customer service user reviews.
Yep, yeah. And again, it's like nothing that, you know, it's kind of out of your ballpark at that point. Whereas one of the key selling points for developing for something like a console is that you have a fixed hardware target to hit. PC, kind of all over the place too, but mobile devices, it's a complete crapshoot. You know, and it's kind of like when, you know, I live in basically an old folks retirement home, right? So these people come knocking on my door all the time. The second they hear I work in tech, can you fix my computer? I begrudgingly go over, help them out. And they say, oh, well, you know, this thing worked fine. You know, the browser doesn't even work anymore. What was the last time you updated this computer? 10 years ago. Well, the stuff we were doing in the browser 10 years ago is very different from today, right? It's just a matter of having to update the hardware and, you know, make your game as feasible on as many platforms as possible. And you seem to have handled that correctly.
Yeah, yeah. Like you said, it's working on console back in the day was actually a real joy because you're working on very specific technical specs versus PC when we had to always accommodate for, you know, lowest common denominator there and the worst PCs in the world and worst internet connections in the world. And mobile is kind of the same in terms of, you know, iOS versus Android. Now, iOS is a bit more of a closed box, which you can expect results, but still does some, you know, strange things now and then.
Absolutely.
But Android, you know, there's this, 12,000-15,000 devices out there, and you just really have to blacklist those low-end devices.
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of learning, is there anything specific from the release of that game that you'd want to highlight, or looking back at what you know now, what would you have done differently, specifically around Wraithborn?
Around Wraithborn? So the market really changed in 2012. You may know there's a little game out there called Clash of Clans.
Yeah.
that was released, I think, around the summer, September of 2012. Mm-hmm. And when that came out, everything changed. The markets, the whole app store, everything changed. So, you know, it completely shifted in a matter of 6 months from premium products to free-to-play products and kind of caught people off guard, us included, and we were so close to getting done that that it was, and we didn't have the experience of free-to-play or live back-end servers or anything like that. So, you know, in the following year, we did spend time to basically make the game free, not freemium, but free, just to kind of gain more downloads and you know, the game has sort of run its course already, so. Put it out there, got in some IEPs, kind of use it as a testing ground for us to learn what works and what doesn't in the free space without having a true free-to-play design around it. So in the end, Wraithborn, we did learn a lot from that and for us to make that into a true free-to-play game would have been a lot of effort. It would have required, you know, a pretty big team, more than the two or three that we had.
So it got to be redesigned and, from the ground up, you think?
Yeah, exactly. And really kind of followed watched what other people were doing, what was working, what wasn't. So we kind of shifted focus in year two to learn free-to-play design and also to look at games that had a very long tail in the App Store. Yep. And that's kind of where we led to like base building and building battle games or simulation or real-time strategy, whatever term you want to call it. But that's ultimately why we shifted focus to changing the strategy genre.
Okay. So strategy genre, which naturally led to Monstrosity, which again, very catchy name because it's Monstrosity, Strocity, like a Monstrosity. The first time I saw it, I was like, I see what they're doing here. it looks like you guys have had great success with this. You know, even your trailers are, you know, looking at the Facebook page, so the trailer featuring Bombageddon, right? It's like a goat with, you know, rocket pack on his back. Like super, super well produced and nicely done. How does a developer go about getting something like that? Do you do it in engine with Unreal, with your own employees? Do you have some kind of studio outsource that work for you? How does it work?
Actually, that was all done in studio. Wow, so nice. I'm pretty proud of the internal art team here. We're small. There's four artists, so two 3D artists, an animator, and an effects artist. And them combined with one of our designers who did all the video editing work basically put that together.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, they did a great job. So everything you're seeing there on the screen was basically rebuilt in 3D Studio Max and rendered from there.
Holy cow.
Yeah, so we had to, you know, package up. We created our own kind of mock city based off of a real city in the game.
Yeah,
and got our lighting and everything down, and it's all rendered from 3D Max and then composited together. So
that is work.
Yes, it was quite a bit of work. We did all the storyboards, the sound design, the audio we purchased for the music there. But it was a couple of months of work, I think, we got it done before Christmas there.
But it's one of those things that really allows a game to stand out. And it's another point I want to drive home to developers is it's very, very seldom about, you know, you kind of working in a corner by yourself or a couple people, you know, in quiet or secrecy. And then one day, you know, you just have a game like, ta-da, here you go, right?
You
know, from your, you know, just looking at the work that you guys have produced, you know, you're clearly doing marketing and PR around it. You have those videos you put together. Even on the Facebook page, you can see it's like, you know, 1,000 likes or whatever. So like as people are starting to, you know, really catch on with your application, you're kind of rewarding people and showing them that you're paying attention to it. So do you have any feedback or suggestions about that? Any maybe lessons learned about community from that regard?
Yeah, I mean, so basically the history of the game, I guess to back up a little bit, is we were originally partnered with a German publisher called GameForge. So we'd been working on this game with them. It was our original pitch. Started with Jeff and I about 3 years ago, almost 2.5, from the original idea pitch.
Yes.
And then it was a slow kind of going of, you know, getting that greenlit, then getting a game design document, and getting that greenlit, and then doing a prototype and getting that greenlit. So it was a really long process in the early stage there of just the two of us. And then once the project got greenlit and then being a go-ahead, then we started ramping up the team, you know, 5 people, then 8 people, and now currently 16 people.
Yeah.
So over that time, you know, the game has gotten developed. We were creating a back-end system at the same time as developing the game and a lot of new features going in. Probably some steps there that we should have maybe done more up front and less later on. But you know, it was a really interesting process, but it did take some time there to start from scratch. Ultimately, when GameForge closed down their mobile division last October, we took back the global rights, and it was at that point where we had to make a decision on what do we do as a publisher? Do we self-publish? Do we find another partner? You know, in the end, we decided to self-publish, and kind of convert our team into a live operations team with a full customer service, community management, marketing. So many people on the team kind of take on different roles or dual roles in overlapping some of those skill sets.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm pretty proud of the team for switching gears like that. It's not easy to do when, you know, we're taking on help shift tickets and, yeah. and helping solve problems, but also making the game. But, ultimately what it did was it really connected, the developing team to the community, I think, and really kind of got, you know, firsthand experience on why we're making this game and what's resonating with the fans, and able to kind of make decisions for future features based off of that. So,
okay.
So when it comes to the,
you're iterating, learning the entire time.
Yeah, yeah. And when it comes to the marketing, I do all the marketing and the social media right now.
Yeah.
And I really try to focus on a cohesive sort of brand message, something that I, you know, really learned at Microsoft during the time there, and some interesting key art that is consistent across all media channels, and kind of delivering the same sort of message around all media channels, and also being human, just showing right. that we're real people making a game.
Yeah, you're not like some faceless organization.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
One of the things that really stood out to me when we first met was, you mentioned this earlier, right? You were simultaneously building your game and backend as a service. And I want to, you know, cover what that is quickly, but then I want you to dive into, you know, when, why, how. But for those who don't know, backend as a service, essentially things like the video I have on screen now. You can see we have resources listed on screen. We have available loot. Maybe there's, you know, their version of leveling and progression, right? All of this is saved on a server somewhere. But you want your users to be able to purchase items or have some sort of currency, in-game currency, rewards. And that's exactly what your team was building. So one thing I think your team really nailed, you know, they were excellent in executing, was creating these backends of services, rewarding the player, right? And constantly engaging them, whether it's through something like a sale or letting them know new characters available. So can you walk us through that process? Because that's what I think really allows your team and this your title to stand out from the crowd.
Yeah, developing the back end is extremely difficult. And just making it all work cohesively in the game. Basically, you know, we're at a point where every single feature in the game uses the back end in some way or another, right? So we don't want people being able to go and hack the game. So there's a difference between what we call the client, which is basically the game running on your phone or your tablet, and the back end server verifying everything that you do. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some videos out there on YouTube and stuff like, oh yeah, the hack monstrosity, you get all these gems, but honestly, it's not. It's showing that on the phone or device that you're using, but yeah. It's not, none of that is actually being verified on by our servers. So
right, and then once it actually goes to hit your server, then it's like no, this is not legitimate because that's not what we're showing.
Exactly. So if they were to restart the game, they basically would all be reset back to normal. So that
it's kind of their way of easily getting YouTube hits, only to exactly. be downloaded later on. People see it doesn't.
Yeah.
Work.
and on that note, hacking is a huge, huge problem, even on mobile. For instance, when Wraithborn was first released as a premium product with no back end and no basically software to protect us from fraud, there was a video up on YouTube within an hour with the game hacked.
So, holy cow! Like a free version copy that people could just sideload.
Yes. Yeah. Jeez. So that's how fast people are. So yeah, developing the backend technology really does help us out, and it also allows us to customize, you know, game balancing on the fly. So if a monster's too strong, we can make it slightly weaker. Or if you're not getting enough loot from a win in a battle, we can, you know, reward the player with more. So it really helps us out to change our game balance. And for instance, we just updated our matchmaking, and players were getting matched up with really strong cities and such, because we were just doing a different algorithm. So we were able to do all that on our backend servers without even updating the game through Apple or Android.
So no one needs to get any change, right? It's really just when they actually launch the game, they go up, they'll connect to your cloud or your server somehow, and that new data comes by, and they are none the wiser unless you have some kind of patch notes or update. And
exactly.
And more than anything, right, it illustrates the importance of not just one and done, not just releasing your title, then getting out the door. Now, it's today's successful games are SaaS, software as a service, where you're constantly providing more value to the customer. And then in return, you know, you're hoping they stick around. And, you know, that's where the concept of whales comes from, you know, in terms of gaming and making dollars, where maybe 95% of your audience may not pay anything, but it's that 5%, that small percentage that's really putting the money into your game, and they kind of create the revenue that keeps most companies afloat. But hey, you absolutely nailed it in terms of back end.
Yeah, we call it GaaS, games as a service.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And then also you can even look at your server technology as like your own kind of DRM, right? Because I know I play a lot of MOBAs and games that are constantly patched up, and if your version does not match your competitor's version, they just won't even play. Right, so that's your way of keeping them up to date with your latest changes all the time. You can even have the potential to do checks to make sure that you're running the same version. So
exactly.
Yeah, there's a number of valid reasons for why you do, you know, what you would do. Are there any like challenges or lessons learned or things you'd like to share with other people who would consider, you know, using a backend as a service as well? Do you write your own? Do you use a cloud? What, you know, what works?
I, for one thing, I think it's a must-have. It just makes life so much easier when you're able to do, even at the very basic point of being able to sort of update stats. If it's a, say, an endless runner, you can update the speed of which they run and the rewards of what players are getting, so you can kind of fine-tune it easily. In terms of custom-built versus not, there are a lot of good products out there like PlayFab and I think GameSpark that do offer kind of off-the-shelf games as a service backends, and they're very good. We actually started with PlayFab originally, and then built up our own backend from that. Wow.
That's impressive. So now, for those kinds of developers, are you typically finding like game developers or software engineers, like IT pros? What do you think works best for that kind of individual?
For the role of handling that? Or?
Yes.
Yeah, so that's basically a back-end software programmer. We use basically, I think it's, I'm not on the back-end technology, so yeah, I think it's PHP calls, but some people use Java, and there's various ways of, you know, going back and forth. Supercell, I think, uses Java for a lot of theirs. So, but yeah, basically, and that role doesn't have to come from video games per se, because there's a lot of like software as a service that have been doing back end systems for years and years now. So there's some crossover there in that particular type of role.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is because again, a lot of developers want to get involved. They're not sure who they should be hiring or what they should be looking for. But the more I see things like GameSparks, I work at Microsoft. We obviously partnered with them a while ago because a lot of what they have is built on our cloud. It really illustrates, you know, the value it can bring to gamers. You know, you're using it. People like Carmageddon are using it. A lot of the AAA like end up honestly rolling their own cloud or, you know, building their own backend as a service on our cloud or a competitor's one. But it is really the difference, the game changer that allows your title to stand out. And I say that as someone, you know, who heavily relies on it. I play a lot of Paragon. I'm, you know, the max level there. But the reason that game is such a success, and same with the other MOBAs, is because they are updated each week, right? We're all on the same page. The game is constantly encouraging, you know, the user to keep coming back and keep doing more.
Exactly.
So we covered just about everything I wanted to get over here. Before we get out of here, though, I'm going to end the show the way I do every other. And that is, the previous guest I had on, Gil Almoghi, he had asked a question. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a question. I'd like for you to answer it. And then afterwards, I would like for you to come up with a question for our next guest. Now, I know who the next guest will be. You won't know until the next time the show airs, but Gil's question for last week. You ready?
Go ahead.
Okay, it was, what is a game that reminded you of your father?
Oh, boy. My father was a baseball player. He's in the Manitoba Baseball Hall of Fame, as is his nice. Father. So there's a kind of a lineage of baseball there. So I'm going to go back to one of my favorite baseball games was Ken Griffey Jr.
On the Super Nintendo.
Yes.
Very good game. Yeah, it came out at a good time, like late 93, early 94. You know, Donkey Kong Country just came out. Yeah, that whole system was on fire at that point.
Yeah, that's back when sports games were fun.
Right? And now, you know, you find they're trying to kind of dumb them down again with re-releases. Of, even MLB with 2018 just came out. And at GDC, what they were showcasing was not like, you know, the new simulation features and crazy details. It was a game that came down to basically like just big fonts, big characters, silly, you know, NBA Jam style.
Yeah, and, I love those games.
Right, like games you can pick up and play, not too serious. It's like, hey, I've got 30 minutes to burn. Let's have a blast here.
Yeah, kind of like mobile games, but shrink that down to 3 minutes.
That's right. Yeah, it's a great when you're standing online or you're waiting for something.
Perfect. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so do you have a question for next week's guest? So it can be anything, but it has to involve gaming in some way.
Okay. Just trying to think here. You're putting me on the spot.
That's half the fun.
I have no idea who it's going to be, so I'm just going to kind of go with I'm going to say what in terms of their career, what it's a gaming person, you said, or yes. Software person? Okay,
gaming person.
So I'm going to go with what was their most favorite project to work on in their career and why?
Very good question. Favorite project to work on during their career and why? Got to make sure I get this down for next week. Great. Well, before we get out of here, are there any last notes you want people to be aware of? Where can they reach you? You know, what would you like people to know? You know, what is your pitch as we're on our way out?
Yeah, sure. It's first of all, just thanks for having me here. It's been a pleasure. I don't do a whole lot of podcasts or anything, so this is always a joy.
I'm glad to be here. So yeah. Social media, where can we find you? Do you have a personal Twitter account? Do you have a Alpha Dog Games one? I mean, obviously, I know you have that, but...
Yeah, I mean, my personal Twitter account is at Synecticos. It's a weird spelling, so it's Synecticos.
OS.
Yeah.
Okay, perfect. And I'm going to have all this in the show notes too, but it's good for me because at least I get to write it down.
Yeah, that's it's a Greek term that means it's the art of thinking creatively through scientific analyzation.
Okay.
So, so that's my personal Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn too. My name, just search for Sean Woods. Yeah, even my own website is seanwoods.com, which is pretty outdated, but... for Monstrosity, playmonstrosity.com is the website for that. Yeah, there you go.
Monstrosity.com. Perfect. Sweet. Well, thank you again for hopping on. Hope to see you again soon, whether it's at GDC, PAX. You ever make it down to any of those PAX events?
I haven't been yet. I've never had a project where I've been there for PAX, but I am looking forward to eventually going one day and preparing for that, maybe being on the show floor as well.
Oh, yeah. The Indie Mega Booth. Good people to be in touch with.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you again, Sean, for reaching out. I will let you know as soon as the show goes live. And love to have you back on the next title you work on.
All right. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Thank you.
All right. Enjoy. We'll be right back.